First of all, I would like to say that it's a real pleasure for me to be here and with these topics, because these topics was my first love when I discovered sign language 20 years ago. I don't know precisely why, but when I began to learn sign language as a foreign language for me, as a late learner, and to study the grammar of French sign language at the beginning, my first interest was in role shift. Maybe because, according to me, it was a very good place to see the linguistics part of a visual gestural language. And I met Christian Cuxac very early, and it was a great opportunity for me because he developed first, since the 80s, he developed a typology where role shift have a specific, have a central role. For him, role shift, he called personal transfer, but no problem with the terminology. For him, role shifts are fully linguistic structures, because they are morphologically compositional. They have different degrees of iconicity. I mean with three kinds of iconicities. And they are, of course, simultaneous constructions. So it's these structures are a real challenge for linguists, for linguistics. Of course, today I won't present all the categories, but he began with, I think, 11 to 12 different categories, and in my PhD in 2003, I added 11 new categories. I have corpus-based methodology with man and woman, with a child, children and adults, with LSF, and now with 9 different sign languages all over the world. So we try with the team to see and to watch if these different types of categories, we are very interesting, but the different kinds of approach. So today it's very interesting for me. Of course, we take into account Irithmer, body as a subject. We work also with Kersi Cormier, with constructed action, etc. Scott Liddell with surrogate spades. Excuse me for the terminology. I have somewhere here different kinds of terminology. So it's very, very important for me to see the link, to see the bridges between the different categories. And for me, it's so important to share. And what I saw this morning is very, very common insight, and also different types of categories. So as Annika, you said at the beginning of your presentation, the terminology is very, very different. And maybe we could explain that phenomenon because it's linguistics and because the area is young, is a bit young. So everybody, each person has their own terminology with different approach. And what I like also is that DAS try also to make a presentation between the generative point of view with Zuki, etc., and also with the cognitive grammar, etc. So maybe in the cognitive grammar approach, you can add the semiological approach founded by Christian Cuxac, by myself, by all the team here, Brigitte Garcia, her sign, and all the Ivani Fuselier, who presented yesterday and who worked very deeply on the emergence of sign language and the importance of role shift when children began to sign and began to create language. So it would be very, very interesting. Maybe I will finish with one example. Why I said that this structure, all 20 structures are fully linguistics, even if they incorporate, they embedded some gesture, is because they are compositional. I mean, if you change one hand or one part of the body, he changed the nature of the structure. So for me, it's the definition of the compositionality. It's a paradigm. So, for example, in one of the structure, we have, for example, in the left structure, you have a signer who embodies a cow, as a first agent, a first entity, and with the dominant hand, in the right hand, she embodies another, a second agent, a horse like that. So it's an example for us as a double transfer, but you can have a different double transfer. You can have this one, but here it's not this one, it's this one. So, you know, here in this, if the signer signed this, it represents the legs of the cow. Here she chose another possibility. She chose to maintain the form, the proform of the lexical items, the cow. Cow in sign LSF is like this, cow. So it's just an example of the compositionality. You can have another example of a particular complex structure, a double, semi-double transfer, where the signer embodies a dog with the body, the shoulder, the facial expression, the eye gaze, you see. But with the non-dominant hand, she represents a tree, and the dog looks at the tree. I mean, in the tree there are birds, and before there are cats, and the cats would like to eat the birds, but the dog arrives, and he would like to protect the birds, the little birds. And here you see the facial expression. The dog is very angry, and he looks at the cat on the tree. So it's a combination, a very complex combination, where the dominant hand, the right hand, show a lexical signs as to show, regarder, to show. The signer only see. But the signer could choose to show the dog who sees the cat in the tree. And she would have signed only like this. But she decided to show this one. So it's another kind of linguistic complexity, of linguistic combination. So thanks a lot for your presentation. And I think we have many things to share. And of course, with the different parts of my work, of my former research, I try to have some quantitative overview of the different kinds of personal transfer, double transfer, whole transfers together, lexical signs, etc. So this slide is only an overview. And year after year, as I already said, I began with a team, with deaf and hearing researchers, to continue in the same line, but in different types of language, as we presented last year in TESOL in Australia. Thank you very much for your attention.
And I will be the guy who is invited and who speaks about something else. So So it's just an attempt to reconciliate Renaissance perspective and role shift in sign languages. And I mean, it's really an attempt. So, okay. So I would like to make a kind of step sideways. And my broken English is better when I read my English. So, my broken English. So we can consider the change of perspectives or the role shifts in sign language as a specificities of a specificity of sign language, or we can consider what is the perspective in general. I mean, the perspective invented in Italy during the Quattrocento, and consider with Erwin Panofsky, this guy, Panofsky. The perspective as a symbolic form. So this last approach claims that a symbolic form transforms all of our manner to consider a phenomenon. In that way, the perspective or the role shift should transform our manner to consider or to analyze sign language. So this is exactly the key point for the different approaches in sign language. It was the key point, and it is the key point today. So for some people, the role shift is not a full linguistics-like phenomena. For other, the role shift, or more generally, the transfer structuring, like the Cuxac model, is the genuine origin of sign language. So in both cases, perspective can be considered as a symbolic form because it transforms all of our manner to consider what is a sign language exactly in the same way. Perspective transformed the conception of the space of the representation in history of art. So according to Panofsky in History of Art, the perspective changed our conception of the relation between the representation and the reality. The representation becomes more related to the reality because the perspective seems to be more natural, closer to the reality. Sometimes the representation and the reality mixed up, and this is maybe the case here. But we have seen a lot of cases in sign language as well. So in a certain way, the semiological modeling of Christian Cuxac as a referential conception of the representation, the more naturalistic a sign is in this representation of an event or an entity, the more genuine the sign is. In this sense, a dictionary sign, a standard sign, has a degenerated iconicity, a bit like if this kind of signs is secondary or consecutive signs. So the signs with the perspective, or in the other words, the sign with the high iconicity level in the Cuxac approach, are more representative than the other signs, probably because of their realism. We can say that this approach is fully committed to a naturalistic conception of the representation. On the other hand, another approach considers the role shift signs as a pantomimic action and not really as a sign because of its wholeness. Wholeness? It's okay? Okay, thank you. Because of the fact that it is a gradient phenomenon. To say it briefly, a kind of referential interference that contravenes a non-referential conception of linguistics. So this approach does not really think that perspective has an impact on the rule of representation. But a new perspective is coming, which will change totally our conception of representation. The mocap and the VR, the virtual reality, are coming. The question now is, can we continue to have a conception of the representation stuck in the Renaissance perspective when the third dimension is not only represented now with mocap, but capture? One seminal paper written last year by Susan Golden-Meadow and Diane Brentere summarized the questions about what belongs to gestures and what belongs to a language in sign languages. One of the issues is the mocap to finally know the supposed gestural part in the movement and in the location in this paper. So I claim that it is impossible to answer to these questions for three main reasons. First, the frame of reference. If we continue to appreciate the movement only through an egocentric frame of reference because we simply not get out of a representation, stuck in perspective, when we have to get in each part of the body which is captured in its 3D dimension, 3D, so three dimensions. The second reason is about the focus of on the hand. If we continue to consider the hand as a single support of the location and the movement, it means considering just the path and the kinematics of only one point in movement, while we capture now the data of all of the segments and not the image of them. And this is an issue. And the third issue is the postural analysis of the sign language. If we consider that the phonology of sign language is composed just by postures, and if we continue to rule out the movements in our phonological models, then we did not get out of the main problem painting and sculptures always have. They cannot represent the movement. So we must consider sign language in multiple intrinsic frames of reference, those of each segment of the upper limb. Doing this, we bring an answer to the first reason, the frame of reference, but meanwhile to the second reason, the focus on the hand, and to the third, because we are able to appreciate the movement and the ongoing of the movement between the segment of the upper limb, and that's it. Thank you.
I also want to thank the organizers. I haven't been here yesterday morning, but I've been here yesterday afternoon, and I think that we're having a very nice and good exchange of ideas. So I want to thank Asaf for having organized this, and both Daz and Hanika for having give very interesting talks this morning. So there is one question that I think was not introduced properly maybe this morning, and the question is, why is it so important that we discuss about role shift in sign language in different perspectives? And I think that, so, and that's maybe because we are biased, since we are sign language linguists. It's so obvious that role shift is important because it's everywhere in sign language. So there is no sign language in which we don't have role shift. But if we come from a different perspective, from the perspective of spoken languages, so role shift is sort of bizarre. Okay, so the importance, and it's also part of what Marianne said before, so role shift is giving us a window into the language and linguistics, human language, that... And gives us an opportunity that we don't find, or we find very rarely in spoken languages. And that's not just when we look at the discourse level and the narration abilities of signers. It's even deeper into the very fine-grained aspects of language. In many domains, so for example, if we look just at the empirical level, what the data are, so we know that there is a sort of a bouquet of non-manual components that triggers these particular properties of role shift. But, and this was not mentioned in the previous talks, but there are sign languages in which there are also manual signs that introduce role shift, making it even more manual signs, making it more salient in the sign discourse. And then there is also sort of differences in kinds of role shift, and these have been presented by Annika before, so what has been part of a quotation and what's part of an action. There are also theoretical reasons why this is important. And here different perspectives have fought among each other for many years, and maybe at some point we will come let's say, at a peaceful agreement. I hope so. And there, I am not listing all the, let's say, issues of discussion here, but just to give some highlights. But it's also important because since it is so deep into sign language, it may also offer us ideas on how the process of language acquisition works for signers. And there are many, many aspects that we have to deal with. So, for example, I'm now referring here to something that was not presented in the two talks this morning. But so apparently, the ability to master role shift or how to use role shift is not something that emerges right away when baby starts signing, but it's something that is acquired throughout a long periods of years. And there are different aspects that might be involved. So it could be because so the memory is not developed thus far so that it can incorporate all this simultaneity of modality of expressions that role shift has. It's a problem of managing co-articulation between the two hands. Or is it a matter of mastering the ability of having a discourse plan, a coherent discourse plan, in which to integrate all these points? Or it could just be that per se there is some sort of intrinsic linguistic complexity. These are all open issues. Okay. As a sort of pure linguist, I want to narrow down my small presentation to a very particular aspect, which has both empirical and theoretical, it's interesting for both theoretical and empirical aspects, which is indexical shifting. And the question is, what is shifting? So most of the time, and in most of the examples that we discussed here, so what is shifting is the reference of the first-person pronoun or whoever the signer is sort of representing. Annika very briefly showed that there are other things that could shift. So, for example, the now under role shift may shift. And there is also the here that can shift. So if I produce this sort of this sequence of signs, that could be now, which is April 20, at 20 to noon. So the pointing sign now is me. It's the signer, Carlo. And here is this room, which I forgot the name or the number.
Conference
room. Okay. Very good. But suppose now that we embed this very same sequence within a predicate of saying. So in this actually, it happened yesterday. So Valentina is here. She's a former student of mine. So now these three signs have a completely different meaning. The now means yesterday. The first person pronouns now means Valentina. And here means in my office, meaning Carlo's office, not Valentina's. Okay. So this is an important property that we don't observe very often or we don't discuss very often when we look at works on narratives in role shift. And it's a very interesting property because the question now is, okay, under role shift, are these three, the me, now, and here, shifting together all the time or not? And this is an empirical question that is connected to a more general theoretical problem. Okay, and here comes a very famous example in the field, thanks to Joseph Kerr. The reference is coming in a second. So we need a little bit of scenario, and this is normal in order to trigger role shift. And again, this is something where research hasn't developed very far, so we need to understand more what's needed in the scenario in order to trigger role shift. Anyway, suppose that I met a friend, John, in Madrid, and we discussed about his PhD. And then he ended up producing the example that you see in the slide. And now glosses are very useful because I'm language independent now. This could be any sign language. Okay. So under role shift, the first person pointing pronoun now is interpreted as John. The question for us is, how do we interpret the here? And there is one reading in which the first person pronoun, the pointing pronoun, means John, and here means Madrid. And under this reading, everything is shifting together. But there is, in principle, another reading, which is this one, where first person pronoun still means John, but the here now means Paris. Okay. What is interesting is that, and this is another point that we haven't discussed or we haven't, that was not addressed this morning, is that we normally think that role shift is so powerful that it has basically the same properties across all sign languages. This is not to be taken for granted. Indeed, we do expect role shift to behave sort of differently. And this is what this very famous example shows us, because apparently the first reading with where everything is shifting is available more or less generally, while the other one is not. So what I wanted to show here is that even within this such a powerful representation system that role shift introduces, there could be language variation. So whenever we talk about role shift, we normally think about a unique thing valid across all sign languages, and we build models that are, let's say, thought to be sign language independent or language universal. But maybe we have to think about a more constrained representation of role shift.
So I'm happy to be on this panel and to have a chance to say something to the talks today from my perspective as a gesture person. And I have chosen rather spontaneously the semiotic perspective because this allows me to address certain phenomena that have been addressed this morning. So some of the shared points of interest and perspectives that I have identified is, first of all, the not so easy notion of conventionality. And I'm sure we have all struggled with this. Charles Sanders Peirce has this concept of habit that is in parallel to conventionality, and that in my own work has helped me to understand what happens in co-speech gestures and different degrees of conventionality, which is of course easier to say for gestures, because there is some kind of, there can be degrees of processes of conventionality within a discourse context, within a teaching context. You know, this is very flexible because gestures are not a fully conventionalized sign system, and they do interact with a fully conventionalized linguistic sign system. So that helps, of course, right? So a matter of degree, there are other colleagues, Cornelia Müller and her group, they talk about recurrent gestures as a kind of gesture that is already more conventionalized, so recurring within one culture, for example. I'd like to bring up the idea of reference. Dominique also briefly touched upon it earlier. I would like to claim that reference in gesture is overrated. I mean, or it's a very difficult notion, reference. What does a gesture do? Is there this relationship between a phonological and a symbolic pole? You know, difficult. I mean, we talked about this last night at dinner, the dinner table. Do gestures refer to something, or are they what they are taken to be about? McNeil has also made this point some time ago, which I find very insightful. And Merleau-Ponty also says that the structure of the world is in a gesture. It's not about the the idea that a gesture refers to the structure of the world. So pantomime, you know, I cannot go into all these issues. I'd just like to address them, bring them up. You know, how conventionalized is pantomime? Well, it's on the continuum, the McNeill continuum, according to Kendon. And I think there it is highly iconic, but it's also conventionalized. Then Das said in his presentation today, iconicity is inherent to all structures. So as I have worked a lot with Roman Jakobsen's approaches, I'm of course fully agree with that. And I'm aware of this debate within the sign linguistics community over the history of the field, that iconicity sometimes was stressed and sometimes not, and now it's stressed again. So I think looking at gestures and iconicity, you know, gestures can be as iconic as they want to be. So that might be a good idea. And what kind of iconicity? So is it an image iconicity? I imitate how I rushed, or is it a diagram? Is more schematic, metaphor? Should we look at image schemas, as I proposed yesterday, very schematic images, structures? And so, and then this idea that iconic gestures are also, they interact, I mean, there's some indexicality that comes in, and that's also what Annika talked about today, and that's something I would like to focus on in this small presentation. So, because I have thought a lot about this interaction of iconicity and indexicality in co-speech gestures, and so I would just like to bring up metonymy. I mentioned that yesterday. Metonymy is a way to show how indexicality and iconicity work together, and sometimes a gesture is more iconic and sometimes it's more indexical. And of course, conventionality is always there too, or processes of conventionalization. But it's not so easy. And also viewpoint and metonymy, they interact too. So that means that, our vision of the world is highly partial, so the metonymy comes into that already. I can see you only from one side at a time, and also Dominique's laptop. So when I represent these objects and people with gesture, of course my physical viewpoint right now will influence that. So this partial representation is part of any sign process, and gestures are highly partial and schematic. So we do always filter out some salient important aspect out of some object or scene. So this idea is there's metonymy involved, and viewpoint is also always involved. So that's something we could draw a nice research program on that. So this is, don't get scared, this is just a table I had, so I'm using it. You know, this is just about purse, similarity, contiguity, conventionality, icon index symbol, you are familiar with that, and my attempt to map different kinds of metonymy with these modes. And now I'll be briefly talking about this, and some of this will be familiar to you, so it won't be too difficult to follow, I hope. So internal metonymy means there are some inner contiguity relations within some kind of object like this house, and we isolate them and we use them for gesture representation. That can be an object, can be the toothbrush that came up yesterday. It can also be an action. So in this here, she says, oh, there was great weather in Budapest and it was swimming weather, and she makes this very schematic action. This is metonymic in the sense that it's a schematic action, it's an idealized representation, and it's only the arms. We do need our legs to swim. So it's also, in terms of the body, the entire body and the action, it's highly metonymic. But it's iconic because it's an iconic gesture of swimming. Then yesterday we saw that this person first isolated these basic structures of the background of the painting, and then she switched to becoming the person on the high tightrope. And then she pretended to be holding this balancing pole. So there is an external relationship between her hand and the object, and that would be external metonymy. But both can be with an can interact with an immersed and a non-immersed viewpoint. I can be inside of the painting and have an external relationship to the objects that I seem to be interacting with. So that is how we could bring this together. I've tried this in a recent paper, but there's a lot more to do. So this outer contiguity relationship is used in gesture all the time. We pretend to be holding something, showing something. You know, sometimes we can presume an object, sometimes not. It's not so easy. But for me, this was an insight when I thought about this person. She said, well, there are nouns and verbs, and the noun was kind of sitting on the hand. Well, we cannot distinguish a noun from a verb, and the hand is not the noun. The hand is not iconic of the noun, but there is this external contiguity relationship between the imaginary object and the hand. That is external metonymy, based on Jacobson. And then there are also maybe holding classifiers, Annika. I don't know. I just would like to make this comparison that constantly when people talk about objects, and this in this case, these are linguists talking about morphemes and nouns and so far, so the word between the hands, and then a subcategory between two hands being held. So this is very easy to do when you talk fast. You know, you can pretend to be holding something in your hands in different ways. You know, the edginess, Norman Foster yesterday. I looked at that, you know, very, very brief comparison, German sign language, internal metonymy for the tree, where you have the basic structures of a tree. And then banana, this is like the action where you have to get from the hands and from the action to the object that's implied in the action. And this would be, according to this view, external metonymy. And so would that with viewpoint brought together would be nice to see. I have to stop. I try to come up with this iconicity indexicality continuum. If you are interested in that, you know, the relationship with these indexical elements in gestures. So pointing is prototypical, but body part index, I can, you know, and so forth. Hand object. And this is my last slide. Coming back to these shared interests, the interaction of iconicity and indexicality. So indexicality in terms of anchorage, Annika had a nice example of this here and today and also Carlos later on. So the conditioning of iconic signs through indexicality on metonymy, and maybe the idea that handing classifiers have this indexical element between the hand and what they are showing brings them closer to indexical elements in general in language, you know, for example, shifters, according to Jacobson, or closed classed items, function words. So maybe there is a link, you know, we would have to work that out, but I this idea of being more indexical and more grammatical, that makes a lot of sense to me, you know. So external metonymy from the hand to the handling hand to the object involved, that would be my view. And also gestures are less or differently conventionalized than sign language, so it would be interesting to look at cross-modal processes and what the speech actually does, because the speech tells you what is on your hand, and it's not visible, right? So, and also these sign language multiple markers and articulators, in sign language this is impressive how well this works, because also there is this conventionalization of doing it and the grammatical part of it, and so this seems to support the symbolic aspect of it, seems to support this rapid and well-coordinated viewpoint shifts and the body partitioning according to Dudas, which I find very interesting. So there are a lot of things to be worked out. Thank you very much.
I propose that now Daz and Annika have reactions to the questions they got and to the debate. Okay, so I don't know. Daz, do you want to start?
I have them here too. But now they have to. You have to answer them.
Thank you very much. Oh my God, we have received so many questions, so I will select a few, one connected to what you have just said, Marco. When we're talking about the two-arrowed line, yeah, and why I'm not going into a single direction, I think that's a very good question. When we go from gesture to linguistic, to the linguistic side on the continuum, I saw a video representing an artist performing an artwork. In the gesturing of that action, you can see what I'm doing, this would be on a gesture level. And this would be on the lexical level. But we can go on the continuum on the other side. We can go from the lexical sign and go into the gesture. So we de-lexicalize the lexicon we perform. And this is why the continuum has two arrows, because we travel on this continuum one way or the other, and there is a flexibility to move along that continuum as we express ourselves. I really love what you just said. Carlo, sorry, I said Marco before. Carlo, with the example of the here and the now in Madrid or in Paris, that's such a brilliant example and triggering a lot of thoughts. When I'm really in some place and integrating an imaginary place or a surrogate space, you remember that there was the mention of partial. Judith mentioned partial embodiment for the representation of space. You can use an arm to present space A, that imaginary place, and the rest for the reality place. And in many sign languages, that is possible. In LSF it is, in British sign languages, in ASL it is. So let me think of an example. Marion, we're working in Italy.
In Quebec.
And when, after discussion, we decided to explain and to present to others what we had discussed, we referred to Marion when she wasn't there. And then we embodied, actually, the fact that she asked or was asked a question, and we referred to a space where she was sat, but at the time of signing, of course, she wasn't at that place. And that is so much showing how, when we embody the time and space, we refer to people to where they were, but in the reality of the place in the room we are, showing the space they occupied in a previous time. Yeah, so, and they're both possible. Yeah. I don't know, do you want me to go on, or? Another question was to do with L1 and L2 and enactment. And like Annika said in her presentation, or compared the presentation of an L1 and L2 narrator or narration, we can see that in the rendition, the prosody, we can see the difference, and these stack up the when the signer is an L1 is L1, the layers flow more than when the enactment is performed by someone else too. And we need to think why this is happening. When do they choose to enact and when do they choose not? Yeah, we need to think when they choose to enact or when they choose to not enact. Quinto Pozos in ASL was asking the question about the compulsion. Why a signer would feel at some time that he had to do the embodiment, the enacting. And if we said to someone, you can't do the role shifting, you can't do the enactment, it's impossible to remove it from your narration. You know, when somebody is in the process of discoursing in sign language, we see it happening. We just observe it everywhere. And what's the function of enactment? And this is something that I'm just beginning to touch upon. We know the iconicity is there. We know we can take it or leave it. But when we do the choice and when we use it, we need to think what is the compulsion to do it, to use it or not. When there is a double enactment, we've seen an example and a person has asked a question, you know, that we see in theory it is possible. Langnacker, yeah, I'm not saying this right, from the cognitive approach, says that partial gesturing and linguistic production is possible in a kind of composition. You can, in a combination way, you can use, you know, enactment exclusively or enactment in combination with. Sorry, I missed it. or a double enactment. There is so much variety in role shifts. You know, there's a big area to look at, different models. And in France, you have such a long history of research in this field, and we're kind of coming together in this place where, you know, I'm so excited and interested to further exchanges with our respective researchers.
Yes, okay, that's better. Okay. Yes, I completely agree, right? So if we sort the terminology and then discuss in the coffee breaks, etc., so we find some common language, and this is really interesting to see that it works. It's this, the phenomenon is the same, but then if you approach each other, then you have different perspectives, of course, but you use the same data-driven perspective, right? So I think there we get together at least partially, I would say. Okay, so thanks for the questions here. It's very, very intriguing to have this kind of different impulses to get. And I'd like to get back to a few things that I wrote down. First of all, an interesting point is that Carlos said that it's very bizarre, the phenomenon of role shift to find in spoken language. I would say, yes, you don't find role shift in that way in spoken language, but if you look at storytelling, you find a lot of those enactment things in spoken languages, and you find voice quality differences, you find facial expressions and gestural differences. So I don't know whether I would draw a distinctive line or also a continuum again. This seems to be like a common base as well today, from something like enacting in spoken languages to enacting in sign languages. Maybe the difference is not too broad because we are so conventionalized with written language and the most of the research is on written language. If you look at spoken language corpora, you find a lot of systematic chaos as well there, right? Okay. And then there is a question about whether you have some kind of elements in DGS, for example, to indicate this quotation. So we have this quotation marks that we can say if we really want to quote. But this is emphasizing quoting. This is not what we would call a quotation element, right? So maybe this is an answer to one of the questions here. Another interesting question is about the egocentric and the non-egocentric view. Of course, if you have fables and stories to tell, then you'll take the egocentric kind of view of these animals and the characters. So there you choose more of an action role shift than, for example, in a formal speech. But as Der said, in all of the text types or presentation types, you find action role shift. Even in formal presentations, you find it. Maybe less, but you also find it. So it seems to be a common property of language. And the egocentric and the exocentric, or maybe like the internal or external perspective, or maybe observer's perspective, as we talked before, this triggers what kind of classifier we use in action role shift or in role shift as such. This has an influence. Which kind of perspective do I take? On the means that I use, I would say. Okay. So for a very specific question, like the noun that appears in a role in a action role shift, can that be extraposition? And I would say yes, maybe, right? I haven't really looked at extraposition, like a syntactic movement. Okay, so that can be the case, right? So I haven't really looked at it from a syntactic point of view, but I found this, and now we can, if it is a systematic and not just a mistake, like a memory mistake, as Cormier said before, then it can be, right? So my answer would be yes, maybe. Okay, and then there's also the perspectives. Is there a hierarchy in dominant roles and non-dominant roles, right? So at some point with the lion and the mouse, we found an example, and some people said, well, it's more of the mouse in this action role shift. The body is only there because the lion is there, and it's non-dominant in this perspective. So you would say it's only the mouse. I would say it's both, but you have a hierarchy, right? So the more articulators you use for a certain character, the higher it is in the dominance of the character perspective, right? But still, you have the body, and without the body, you would not understand the context. So the proposition would be not fully understandable if you don't have this other perspective being active as well, right? Can be more dominant, of course, depending on the articulators, but also one articulator that is very salient and prominent, for example, as the body, can be the dominant person, right? Doesn't mean that the hands are the dominance or the face is the dominance. It depends on the constellation of this character mixing. I would not go for a number of articulators, as for example, Cormier et al. Did in one paper, said the number of articulators says that this is the hierarchy of subtle CA, so subtle constructed action or strong constructed action, right? I would think about it in a more complex way, saying, okay, what is the common context and the active and salient and also accessible referent in the context, right? So maybe going with accessibility theory with Ariel. I don't know whether that says something to you, but Mira Ariel has done something about accessibility theory where referents are accessible depending on the distance of the discourse and the reference and what kind of anaphoric relation is active, for example. So it's not just one hand or two hands or more. Yeah. Okay, and then I link two questions. One question is about the body as subject, and the other question is about the agreement analysis and whether that can inform us about theories in general. So what I say is that if you look at, for example, agreement verbs, there's the debate on what is obligatory and what is optional, right? So you have subject and object agreement verbs that go from one place to another, but you very often find the omission of the subject, right? So if you say person A is on the right and person B is on the left and person A helps person B, well, I'm using the interpreters a little bit to not show the example, Okay, so person one is on the right and person B on the left, and then one helps the other. Sometimes just you start at your own body, but you go to the object. So the object is the obligatory part, and the object agreement is more obligatory than the subject agreement, and you can omit the subject agreement. With role shift, it's also the case that you take over the subject as the body, but the orientation towards the object is more obligatory, right? So within role shift, it's the other way around. Action role shift, you have the body, you are the character, and the subject is the most important thing, right? So that means that, for example, it's not the subject. I'm calling it the signer and the addressee, or the character, and not subject and object, because these are grammatical categories. So here you can have like a transformation from the agreement optionality and obligatoriness discussion to the role shift part, and that maybe helps you to understand why the subject, the body as subject, is more important in action role shift, and the object is more important in quotation role shift, because from action role shift to quotation role shift there's like a grammaticality development in you can say, right? So it's more of a grammaticalized way of signing quotations, something like this. Well, a lot more. The movement part that Dominique said is really intriguing. We also discussed this before, so we have to look at the movement part and the movement, whether it's morphology or whether it's the gestural information of the movement is triggered by gestural or by morphological reasons. Right. So I think there we can discuss a lot, because that there you see the different approaches and the theories at play, well, which is the right, which perspective does help the data to analyze best? One thing about the pictures. One last thing about pictures. So, if you decide to choose role shift, why do you decide? I think this is one of the last questions that Das said. I was always wondering what are the triggers for also L2 learners, but also for native signers, to choose to show something in role shift or in action role shift. And I found that as soon as there you have like emotional adverbials or some kind of reference that interact, this is the second one. And the third one is something like, if you really want to add more information about the behavior, then you choose to do it in action role shift. But you can, of course, do it in the other way around. But like adverbials are facial expressions, usually. And if you have facial expressions, sentence adverbials being expressed by facial expressions, then it's easier to have the role shift than to have lexical and facial expression spreading over the sentence, right? So it seems that there are different triggers at play to what extent you decide. Are you going to do action role shift or constructive action or enactment, or are you doing it lexically? I think this is something that we could also find a hierarchy in. What are the triggers and what are the most important triggers as opposed to subtle triggers for the choice of action role shift? Right, so I would go there. Are there further questions or time-wise? Well, yeah, I can go on forever to talk about. I didn't go through both.
Especially for interpreters who are like dying. So
yeah.
We have 15 minutes.
Okay.
A few minutes, because I haven't gone through the part where it says both. I didn't have the time to read through it to the end. So maybe I'll give the chance. Give the chance.
So one of the things that all of you emphasize is that there are sort of different ways and sort of different traditions at looking at, or everybody, many people up there emphasize that there are different traditions at looking at this phenomena, and, you know, they each come with their own vocabulary and stuff. I was because of this, it's sometimes hard for me, as somebody who hasn't really looked at role shift in sign language, tried to study it yet, to know what if there are points of disagreement. So are there fundamental debates which you feel that there's still sort of fundamental disagreement about how these things work? Or are we sort of more or less converging on the main page, or like the same? Are we all kind of on the same page? And then there are questions, for example, with these segmenting the body parts to describe different things. These are kind of hard for everybody. Or maybe these cases that Annika mentioned, then Carlo Geraci again mentioned, where you have mixed, or you don't have things shifting together. That's kind of hard for everybody. But I was wondering if there are, if you feel like there are different fundamental positions on these or not. Anybody can answer that who feels like they have something to say.
So who is brave enough?
Well, maybe I'll just start by repeating to those holes, right? So the mixing. So some sign languages do have this really direct interpretation, and some sign languages have this option of shifting. Right? This is the at the moment databases and or analysis on the databases. I don't know whether you really have to say that this local and temporal indexicals, whether they have this intrinsic lexical specificity that they are ambiguous in terms of contexts, right? So, for example, as I said, with the here, this is still a debate, how you interpret those mixing, right? I think this, and some people say it's a lexical reason, and some people say it's a pragmatic reason. Some people say that if you jump out of the world shift quickly, or right, and then you have to have this eye gaze to have this unquotation, but you'll find unquotated material without any kind of indication that you go back into the role and not, because you don't always have the whole body moving clearly from one side to the other. So it is not really marked at every point. So I think this is a point where we haven't really decided how to analyze this temporal and local indexical mixing, right? I'm not saying that I'm skeptical about that in ASL or in LSF there's not such a case. I don't know, it hasn't really appeared. They have been tested. Philippe has tested those things to LSF and also ASL, I realized. So however, in terms of interpretation, the perception experiments or perceptional stuff has not really been analyzed a lot. So we have to wait for this kind of perceptional analysis to see the differences there. But I think this is one point where we haven't really clearly said which direction it should go.
I really think that sometimes it's good to clarify when the disagreement is real and when it's just terminology. And maybe as an area in which a disagreement is still real, I don't know, is the fact that with role shift and classifier predicates, there is a demonstration part. And so in some theories, this demonstration part is fully linguistic. In other theory, it's a non-linguistic part incorporated into sign language grammar. So I think that's still an area in which there is debate and disagreement. So, for example, theories like the theory that was the theory, the idea, the intuition that was originally proposed by Sandro Zucchi and more recently by Davidson, really is a way to maintain a part of the old idea that these constructions are not linguistic. Now, no one can say that literally. I think we all agree that there is an important linguistic component, but these theories say that there is a demonstration part which in itself might not be linguistic. And other approaches stress, as Marianne said, the compositional part. So that's an area in which I think there is still disagreement and still research to be done. So. And sometimes it's good to focus disagreement as well in a very, friendly way. The debate should be friendly, but I think it's also important to know what we don't agree on.
Mm-hmm.
Shall I sit or stand to sign? Or can I just stay where I am? Sorry for the people at the back. Hello, everyone. I'll try to sign in international sign. It's a question and a comment on the theoretical presentation. I think it was all very well, but for instance, when Daz was the first presenter, I was really, really on fire, tuned in, really completely with him in his presentation. And I don't want to kind of point the finger at deaf or hearing presenter, but it's true that in my experience and in my way of processing the information I receive, the explanation on linguistics, well, the presentation by hearing presenter seems to go a long way to the point, and I felt it was harder to reach and harder to understand. And so in terms of pedagogy or learning point for me, watching presentations by hearing people is extremely tiring, and I perceive a very strong difference in my own comfort in listening to Daz or to other presenters. The point were made were excellent anyway, and the combination of the various the information that Daz gave me, what was complemented after by Annika, complemented very nicely, and the whole morning was a great learning moment, and it's not like I'm pointing the finger at anyone saying there was something wrong, but I'm just wanting to share from an experiential point of view, you know, how I am perceiving these presentations. And I was also thinking, okay, I come from a deaf family. I have two deaf children. And we often play on sign, improvise. Like, for example, with the sign ready in LSF, I was signing the jokey sign I was signing with my children, and I was signing this to my neighbor here. Although we're both deaf, she wasn't in on the inside joke at home, and she didn't understand my little sign joke about ready. And that's because we had the same reference we could count on in our family, whereas here, she didn't have that reference. So when we are, you know, signing amongst deaf people and talking about sign language amongst deaf people, you know, like we have linguists presenting about the examples, often referring to animals, and we go, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'm kind of wanting something that I can really chew on, something deep, something that's really, really deaf. And I feel that this is lacking in when the discourse is not held in sign language.
No, the data.
Well, all right, okay. And so I have a... Yeah, I know I need to kind of say it shorter, and I just took the opportunity to just give you that before we close the session.
It's just a point of answering, but who is English native here?
Oh, English
native, okay. So this is just a part of the answer. Just a part.
Can I ask a question?
They are saying, the points you've raised, I'm not going to cover them all in my answer. But first of all, the fact that you tuned in my presentation so well, and that presenters have different styles, and you know, we can't assume that everybody understands. But it's true that when we work as interpreters, there is an extra load on my shoulder, the trust, knowing that the interpreter is just doing their job. And I decided to just make my presentation and trust that it was all going to go well. In terms of tuning in and or not with it's to do with the shared knowledge. And this is a very important point, and I'm interested in what you brought up as a point. For instance, Annika and myself were chatting in a coffee break about, you know, naming or lexicalizing things before embodiment or enactment. And then when I'm, like, signing with deaf people, and there's this example, someone, like, barging in, opening the door. Well, there is no name of a person. We don't need to kind of name or indicate the teacher arrived or somebody arrived in the deaf community amongst ourselves. We know culturally that names are not important. We just open the door and someone comes in. It doesn't matter if...
if I'm at school...
Yeah. The name of the teacher would be this, but deaf people don't need to kind of... give the name of the teacher to see that that person enters the classroom all of a sudden, you know. But there is so many things that are to do with enactment, with shared knowledge, and with the pragmatic sides of linguistics. So, I mean, I'm really linking very well to what you're saying, Aya, and I remember, you know, a lot of presentations were quite theoretical. And this is great for me. I really could, you know, come in and benefit from the shared knowledge, you know. It's not like watching a show and saying, oh, yeah, we agree with everything. No, there's points people are making where I'm considering it, agreeing or disagreeing, and I really value these moments of workshops. And it's not in a kind of belligerent way, trying to kind of oppose people, but it's more that we take and benefit from sharing the research and the knowledge that's presented here. You know, that's my perspective on this.
Yes, to the end of this morning.
Thank you. If we could have the background, the feedback of Chloe, of Liz Santoro, who were there yesterday, I will be very interested to have your feedback because you are in another field. You are in cognition, dance, etc. I would like to have your comments of this morning. It was specifically on linguistics of sign language. Which links could you do? Because in sign languages, you understood that role shifts are completely grammaticalized and conventionalized with different kinds of structures, etc. If we could have a very brief back feedback, or maybe if you need more time.
So if you have a very quick one, because I think we are supposed to really finish if you want to have 1 hour. So
thank you. Just 1 minute, I give you my off the cuff. I also didn't know if you're asking native English speakers sign language or native English speakers. Ah, okay, yeah, then that's me, sorry. I just quickly also say that I start by just saying that I'm also a bit of an alien, more than just I don't speak sign language. English is my native language, so I'm an alien in France. But I'm also an alien in a laboratory and in any kind of academic setting. Like I've since I left Harvard, I ran as far away as I could from things like this, and I don't say this in a derogatory way, but it's like really like since yesterday, I'm a bit. I feel a bit like a. The tortoise in the hare. I feel like the tortoise. But what I'm realizing since this morning, it was really a beautiful and wonderful experience to hear the talks this morning. And I'm sorry, what is his name? Your name is Daz? Daz. And Daz is talking about this continuum between you said delexicalization. voilà, of movement, and I feel like that's, I've spent my whole life doing that. So it's really like, there's a lot of beautiful moments where I can grab onto these connections, but I also just can have as an off the cuff reaction to say that I feel very alien here. So I'm trying to, like, I think similar maybe even to what you're saying. Like, I'm also like trying to catch and trying to, and we all, everyone is going to try to catch the places that they can. That are somewhere how connected to what's going on in their own lives to say, okay, that's where I can try to connect on. And I think there's a place, just to respond to that and also in your question as well, is to, like, to kind of stay in this place of floating and not be too, I mean, it's patience, but it's also, one of the interpreters said to me, it was you, said to me yesterday about, like, I was asking a question about interpreting and how you do this job, because I'm fascinated. I could watch the two of you all day. And you were saying, I'm sorry, I don't even know your name. Brigitte. Sorry, Brigitte. I tried to talk to you. It's very fascinating because I'm talking to her, but she's doing, it's incredible. And you were saying to me about, like, that you need to have, like, kind of courage to kind of, like, jump in the water and do this job and feel, and because it's really, anyway, I just, it's also a reaction that I give from my own perspective, because it's very remarkable. So I say thank you to all of you. Let me, being an alien in your land, in France, and in this room, and in the lab, and yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we should. So it's nice that you sort of finished, because you did a lot of role shift in your... So for those of you who think that there is no role shift in spoken language, okay, that's... So I really think we should close. Let me say two words. First, I would like to thank the invited who participated and the people who participated in the roundtable. So thanks a lot for coming, despite strikes and, you know, all the possible disaster you can imagine, almost all. Flight cancellation and blah blah. So I also want to thank all the people who came to listen. Then I want to thank especially, if I can, Marion and Asaf, because they did most of the work. And last but not least, guess who I'm going to to thank. So really, I mean, they did a huge job, only two people for 2 days for a meeting like this. It's really amazing. So really, thanks a lot. Okay. For those, there is also a close event in the afternoon for the people in the lab. So for those who are here in the afternoon, it should be 1:35. So we have 1 hour break.